Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we explore the science fiction field from all angles, covering the past, the present, and the future. We're your hosts. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we have a guest with us this week. We have not one Cusky in the form of Colin, but two Cuskies, because we have with us Peter Cusky. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Thank you all for letting me join you guys.
Thanks for joining us. Now, Peter's joining us primarily because we've all been reading the same book this last week or so. But we felt, since we're having a guest on the show, let's have the guest on for the entire show so that they're part of the whole discussion and not just there for the one thing. So we'll get to the book in a while. Just before we get to that, we usually like to do a little bit of listener feedback at the beginning of the show. Well, this time I don't have any listener feedback as such, but I have a little bit of news. There is a website called Feedspot, which, to be honest, I don't know how reputable it is, but it has all sorts of lists on it showing best this and best that and 50 best farming podcasts in Arizona and things like that. Anyway, we, Science Fiction 101, turned up on their best UK sci-fi podcast list. We're in there at number 9. So isn't that fantastic? A little bit of recognition from a website I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, it's really nice. Obviously, they're discerning and intelligent people.
Obviously, yeah. I don't dare dig into their criteria for including things in there or ranking them. I think they're taking data about podcast listenership from probably Apple Podcasts, but I'm not entirely sure on that. So it's all a little bit mysterious, but I'm quite happy to receive an award that says you are number 9 in the UK.
Well, and there was a little blurb about each podcast, and they mentioned that you and I are both, film buffs, so to say, and then we talk a lot about adapted science fiction. And
it was all quite accurate and, very positive, so quite pleased to see that. Next week, we'll be at number 1, of course.
Oh, yes.
Now, for the last week or so, we've been reading a book. This was a book that Colin first drew to my attention. I had no idea it existed. It's called The Apollo Murders, and it's written by Chris Hadfield, who is a quite well-known astronaut. Colin, how did you discover this book?
So my local library website has an RSS feed of all their new incoming books. And I go through it looking for books that interest me or my children or my friends or my wife. That's a more rare one. But I saw, The Apollo Murders by Chris Hadfield. And I'm like, Chris Hadfield, I know that name.
For the benefit of listeners who may not know, famous astronaut. He flew on the space shuttle. He flew on Soyuz. He commanded the International Space Station. He famously made a music video for Space Oddity.
Yes.
Even people who don't know astronauts know him because he famously sang a song in space. And I believe he's Canadian.
I think you're right. So there's a little blurb on the book, and it was a brand new release that had just come to the library. So I went out and got a copy of it for my Nook because I suspected that my son Peter might like to read it as well. And I was right. He read the book, finished reading the book 28 hours after I told him about its existence.
Some sort of world record there.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, that's not a record. I read all of World War Z on a 6-hour car ride.
Whoa. Yeah. Wow, you must be some kind of speed reader.
Yeah, Dad and I get in arguments about that a lot.
At first, the rate of reading was so high. I didn't believe he had any – he was either skimming and that his retention or understanding would be lacking. And so when he would tell me that, I would quiz him and regularly get schooled in how well he did understand everything he had read and how quickly he had done it.
Let's go around the table. Peter, it sounds like you finished it before we did. What was your overall impression of the book?
I really liked it. I always appreciate sci-fi that I find to be more, this probably sound really weird, realistic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably going to get a lot of flack from you guys for this, but I forgot there wasn't an Apollo 18 mission in real life. And so, especially the part at the end of the book, he has this entire chapter dedicated to, here's what's real from this book. And I was shocked at how much of it was actually real. Even stuff that's not like historically correct, like this is based on real life. Here's what's real about this aspect of it.
It is a book which you could question which genre it fits into, because it does feel at times like a piece of historical fiction. And at times it's clearly more of a techno thriller or just a thriller than a science fiction work. But I don't care about genre boundaries personally. Colin, what was your take on it?
I thought it was a fun thriller. I love a good hard science read, whether it's The Martian or whether it's, you know, alternative history like this one. Peter, you shouldn't feel bad about not knowing there wasn't an Apollo 18 mission, because the only reason I remember that there wasn't an Apollo 18 mission is that there was a horror movie made, I want to say 10 or 15 years ago with Liev Schreiber, called Apollo 18, about what they found on the purported Apollo 18 mission, which never, ever really happened.
Okay.
There could have been an Apollo 18, because the original plan would have taken them up to about Apollo 20. But the funding got cut because the viewing figures of the moon landings started to plummet after Apollo 12. People just weren't interested. They were interested in the first moon landing, but once it had been done once, people didn't seem to be that bothered about having repeat missions. And so funding was cut. The money was diverted elsewhere. They used up some of the remaining hardware for Skylab, which was the first American space station. Mm-hmm. Which essentially was made out of one of the Saturn V rockets. It's basically the hollowed out interior of one of the stages of a Saturn V rocket.
So are you saying that it was canceled due to ratings, in essence?
I mean, that's a bit of a caricature, but essentially the feeling was that there wasn't public support for it, and therefore politicians weren't willing to support it, and therefore NASA had to start cutting. So, yeah, it's oversimplifying it to say it's ratings, but basically it was ratings. It was basically that.
Wow.
How much should we say about the story itself? Should we do spoilers or should we withhold information? How do you feel about that?
We've usually talked spoilers in the past, even for recent books like Project Hail Mary.
Let's just quickly sum up some of the story then, for the benefit of listeners who may not have read any of the book and may be wondering whether it's even for them. I suppose what we should say is it is basically the fictional mission Apollo 18, but instead of just having a let's go to the moon and explore or do science, there is a military component to the mission, which includes the Apollo astronauts, shall we say, sabotaging a Russian space station. As a result of that, we end up with a Russian cosmonaut on board the Apollo spaceship, and we end up with one dead astronaut. So the team that goes to the moon consists of two Americans and a Russian. And everything that happens after that is kind of, almost all of it is unplanned, I would say, wouldn't you? or possibly unpredictable from that point on.
When you mentioned the two Americans, I kind of did air quotes in my room right now.
Yeah, there's a question as to whether there might be a spy on the mission. And there's a change in personnel at the very beginning of the mission because of an astronaut dying in an accident. And then they begin to wonder, as they learn more about it, was it really an accident?
So, in fact, when I said an astronaut dies, actually two astronauts die, because one dies on Earth and another one dies in space. And a cosmonaut dies as well. So there's actually quite a big body count with this story, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then the ending is, more people are going to die. Let me just say that.
Shock. Shock horror. In terms of the storytelling, there's multiple threads that go on. Our sort of main character that we follow is called Kaz, who is this is going to sound silly. The more detail we give, the more silly this book is going to sound.
Yeah.
Kaz is a one-eyed, a grounded astronaut because he's lost an eye, which sounds very careless of him. Another thread of story is the Apollo mission itself and following us sort of traveling along on the spaceship and seeing what happens on the mission. Another thread is the Russians, who are kind of listening in on the Apollo mission and trying to get one step ahead of the Americans and to trip them up every step of the way. And there's yet another thread which involves a monk / priest from East Germany who is apparently the brother of one of the American astronauts. Isn't that right?
That is exactly right.
Yes.
And there's another thread where it's a, I think it's a Kazakh-Russian minority, a young man who wanted to be an astronaut because he was inspired by Gagarin, but because of his minority status, the best he could hope for was to be an engineer. But he ends up being a lunar rover driver.
And that is a whole other thread too about what the rover is doing on the moon.
Yeah, what the rover does and what it finds, which becomes part of this military Apollo mission.
So let's add in that other thread. The rover on the moon is Lunokhod, which really existed.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the book, it's described as something like a bathtub on wheels. It's used within the plot of the story, and the Apollo astronauts interact with it, let's say, and almost do battle with it. The more detail we feed in on this, the more ridiculous this all sounds. That's not to condemn it, by the way, because I think it reads really well. But there are just so many unlikely things happening. And that's really why, when I was reading it, I kept saying, really?
I had some of those same experiences, but they were in the detail of, you know, everything that they had to do. So you could tell that Chris Hadfield had probably read a lot, had the opportunity to see a lot, given his astronaut status and access to, you know, the launch facilities and maybe mock-ups and exhibits that, you know, normal people might not have access to. And he has been an astronaut. So he's had that experience of going into space to describe what it's like. And that part was really enjoyable to read and experience. But I think I feel like you did. There's just a bit too many layers in here, a thread or two too many.
So you've talked about some of the things there that you really appreciated, which seem to mostly come from the sort of authority that Hadfield brings to the story. You sort of believe a lot of the things that he says, because it sounds like he's experienced them firsthand. Mm-hmm. Peter, what would you say were your favorite parts of the book?
I think my favorite part of the book was the chapter leading up to and being the launch. You could definitely tell that this was written by someone with like firsthand experience of this, because there's so many small details like don't eat a big meal or like eat stuff that'll feel better on the way up.
Yeah.
Than going down. And it's this like little advice you can tell was written by someone who's done this for a long time.
Yeah.
And has like that, oh yeah, this is how you just deal with this now. I'm not sure I agree with my dad, Colin, on the like too many threads. I think there are like five or six main threads, but I feel like he wraps them up pretty well. Like the one about the Russian East German priest, that ends up being used by the Russians to try and connect with one of the astronauts. So I feel like even there are a few too many storylines, but I feel like he wraps them up pretty well.
And it's not as if these things are independent of each other. They do all intertwine. And I think the cleverness of the way that those threads connect together, I think is what saves the book from being a mess, which it might otherwise be. So I would agree with that. I think my favourite scene actually is some of the earlier scenes in the book. I quite like the helicopter crash, because I felt in describing that crash, what Hadfield does first of all is he basically tells you how to fly a helicopter. He describes the helicopter itself, what it physically looks like, what the controls are, how you would operate it to steer it and to make it rise up and so forth. So he tells you how to fly the helicopter, and then the accident happens and he tells you what the pilot is doing to try and save himself. And of course he can't save himself because the whole thing's been sabotaged, so he's doomed. Mm-hmm. But because he takes the time to teach you how to fly a helicopter, you really understand it when the helicopter goes wrong. So I thought that whole section was really very good. It also reminded me very much, again, because I'm an Apollo buff, I happen to know that Gene Cernan, who was the commander of Apollo 17, in real life crashed a helicopter. And it's sort of one of the stories in Gene Cernan's biography. And there was a documentary made about him as well. And it's a story that he used to tell that was one of the most life-threatening things he ever did. In Gene Cernan's case, he crashed the helicopter because he was flying too low and he sort of hit the ground and he ended up crashing into a river. And then he was trapped underwater underneath the burning fuel from the helicopter. And he had to kind of go through the burning fuel to escape. Wow. So that's a very vivid real life helicopter crash that I knew about. And Hadfield's description of his crash in the novel is as vividly real as Cernan's account. And to the extent that I thought, oh, he's basing this on Gene Cernan. A bit later on, the novel actually refers to Gene Cernan, because one of the investigators is said to have had experience through investigating Cernan's crash. So clearly, Hadfield is really mixing in his own experiences of flying, anecdotes that he's picked up on from other astronauts, and then he's building in these sort of real-life figures who interconnect with the story. And I thought all of that was fabulous stuff. But, and there is a big but for me, that is, I'm just trying to get my Kindle on. I made some notes. I never make notes on the Kindle when I'm reading, but I had to make notes on this one because there are so many writing habits that Chris Hadfield has that annoyed me. Let's see if any of these ring any bells with you. Characters gesturing with their chin. Were you conscious of that?
No.
Peter, did you notice that a lot of characters gestured with their chin?
I did not.
It was so repetitive that I just got really annoyed by it. So I started highlighting every time it happened. So there's a bit, here's one line, gesturing with his chin at the two other men. There was another bit. Hurd jerked his chin towards the back of the main floor beyond the kitchen. Let's see if I can find another one. She gestured with her chin at Lunacod. Yes. Gene Kranz's jaw thrust forward. Which I take to mean he pointed with his chin.
Yes.
So this just kept happening again and again. And very early on in the book, I realized that Hadfield was, when he was introducing characters, he was describing them all in a very systematic way. He was sort of starting by describing their hair and then working down to their feet. And he sort of did this every time he introduced a character, and it just felt really clumsy. I wasn't taking notes at the beginning, but the first one where I thought, I've got to make a note of this. This is a character description. A tall, wide man in a grey suit, his hair combed straight back off a broad forehead, thick wire-rimmed glasses magnifying his tired eyes. A few pages on. He was a strongly built man in his 50s, in a rumpled suit and tie, heavy-rimmed glasses below a combed back wave of hair greying at the temples. These descriptions are, I don't know, they're very pulp fiction descriptions to me. Apart from that, I think it's a terrific book.
Every time I read a book, I'm looking for, you know, an interesting plot, great characters, and then every once in a while you come across these incredibly well-written passages. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite things about Day of the Triffids, because the entire novel is just great writing overall. In this story, I highlighted one thing, And it's when Chris Hadfield pulls away from the action, he pulls away from the descriptions and the history and the technology, and he's talking about the manned spacecraft center. The NASA Manned Spacecraft Center was a type of factory. It took in the strange raw materials of human dreams, ingenuity, and tenacity, ran them through a labor-intensive assembly line of development, testing, and training, and spat out astronauts and their support teams ready for spaceflight. Regular as clockwork, best in the world.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I want more of that in what I read. The action was interesting, riveting, maybe a little bit too much in some areas, because at some point you have to wonder, do you really believe that the astronaut or an astronaut might kill someone to get on, and that astronaut would be compromised by the Russian government and have a brother in Russia who could be used to blackmail him? And at the same time, there's an actual Russian cosmonaut on there, and they're trying to fight over the same goal.
It's crazy, isn't it? It's a mixture of brilliant stuff and some things that are, I think, stretching credibility almost to breaking point. But there was just on the description of the Manned Spacecraft Center, there was a passage in there somewhere where our focus character, Kaz, has set up a meeting at the Manned Spacecraft Center. And he's realized that he doesn't know where the room is that he needs to go to. So he's driving around between the buildings. He locates the right building, but then he thinks, now I've got to find somewhere to park the car. And that little description brought that place to life. I've read about the Manned Spacecraft Center. This is the place in Houston, of course, Mission Control and all of that. But somehow he was able to bring whole new dimensions to it by taking us to parts that you never normally see, even simple things like the car park. So there's that kind of realism in there, which I really appreciated. And it must come from his own personal experiences, I'm sure, rather than from just doing research and so on.
Yeah, it makes Kaz very human, I think, because he's fallible.
Yes, that's right. There were some things in the story where I said, really, which were technologically a bit unbelievable. Now, while most of it I believed because it comes across, it has an air of authority to it, there were some things that I thought, surely that can't happen. So, for example, the way the cosmonaut comes aboard the Apollo spaceship is basically that she's clinging on to the outside of it while it is accelerating. Now, I don't know what level of acceleration there would be from that stage of the rocket. I could probably look it up somewhere. But it just felt unlikely because astronauts feel G-forces whenever those rocket engines are firing. So there were a couple of moments like that I was thinking, really? But the fast flow of events and the authority of the book is enough to carry you through a lot of those. And I'm sure a lot of readers wouldn't even stop to think about those things. They just get carried along with the story.
It made me blink because my thought was, how in the world could they be standing on the outside of the capsule as it's accelerating? Then I realized the acceleration is probably fairly gentle because the motors aren't that strong. Mm-hmm. And there's no wind resistance, so it's not like they're going to be blown off. And so if you have good hand, you could probably be there.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what was the G-force experienced by the astronauts inside the capsule during, was it translunar orbit injection?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what they pulled. I couldn't find that quickly. I think Dad makes a good point about how there's no resistance, probably fairly gentle, because he doesn't describe the effects of the acceleration on the astronauts as much. He kind of mentioned rocket start and then ship moves, but in the launch it was astronauts are like frozen against the back of their seats, like stuck in place, really hard to move. And so I feel like there's definitely a difference between there from the way he describes it.
And what he does do is he talks about the fewer and fewer rocket motors with each stage. So with the first stage of the rocket, there are five engines all firing at the same time, and then the next stage it's down to I think four, and then the next stage is just a single engine. So he does sort of account for it in that sense. There's There's one line fairly late in the book where I think we're sort of with Gene Kranz thinking something through. And the book says, a trade-off, like everything in spaceflight, purpose versus risk. And I think that's what the book is trying to do all the time, is it's showing you some things that strain credibility, but he's trying to make you think that the purpose of doing a thing exceeds the risk. Or on some occasions, it's the other way around. The risk is too great, so they don't do a thing. But there are some things that happen where I think the purpose isn't quite clear enough. Again, this is based on my understanding of the Apollo missions from all the things I've read over the years. Once you've got the Saturn V in orbit around the Earth, you choose to then do the translunar injection or insertion or whatever they call it. So you choose the point at which you fire your rocket and actually head off to the moon. Now, in the novel, there's been this whole set of surprising incidents around the Russian space station. They find there are cosmonauts there that they weren't expecting. They've been almost in a fist fight with the cosmonauts. They've been shot at in space. And yet, Houston says, go for TLI. And they do. They just go. Whereas in reality, if anything had gone wrong while in orbit, they would have delayed it. They would have waited for another go-round. You know, because it's simply circling the Earth at this point. So they would simply wait for the next orbit. And if things still aren't right, they'd wait for the next one. Now, he never actually explains what the urgency is in doing the TLI at that moment. So I think he's pulling a fast one on the reader at that point, because I think the risk far exceeds the purpose at that point.
I thought differently about that, because one of the main conflicts of this book is the science versus the military objective. And yes, the whole purpose of the military part, especially for the Russian space lab thing, was that it was supposed to be secret and nobody knew they were supposed to be there. Yeah. Not even like the scientists knew. And so I feel like the quick release was trying to hide. If they stayed around Earth longer, people start asking why they're still here, as opposed to if they just go, oh, we're doing one orbit, then gone.
Right.
So I think that's just trying, like, the military side of it, trying to keep it hush-hush, and putting the entire mission at risk because of that.
That's a fair argument. And it is true that he does emphasize that the military agenda is kind of more important than the normal Apollo agenda throughout this. And I suppose the one other factor is that Chad, the commander of the Apollo mission, is a very driven character, and as it turns out, he's not entirely honest. So maybe that comes into it as well. Maybe there's sort of his personal urgency to do it. I just felt that it wasn't quite justified at that point, and in the back of my mind, I kind of heard Gene Kranz saying, well, hold on a moment. We don't have to do it right now. Let's wait till we come around the Earth one more time. But you could be right there. There's something that I thought was very clever in the book, and that is the whole business of the Russians talking to the Apollo astronauts without Houston knowing that they were doing it. And now, I mean, that sounds like a very unlikely turn of events, but what Hadfield does is he very carefully accounts for they can only do it when the Russian side of the Earth is facing the moon. Okay, so if the moon isn't in the sky in Russia, then they can't communicate with the moon. That's fair enough. But also, they don't want the guy in the command module to hear their transmissions, so they wait till he goes around the back of the moon. So you've got this sort of complicated set of movements going on there, the rotation of the Earth and the rotation of the command module around the moon, which determines when they can talk. And I just thought that was genius. And although it's complex, it comes across as quite clear and obvious in the book.
And to expand on that as well, they also know that NASA has receiving antennas all across the world, so NASA can communicate with the with the mission at all times. So they had to make sure that NASA doesn't hear the Russian, the capsule talking back to Russia. And so they said, okay, if you hear us and agree with this, send one like radio check or something. And then my first thought was a quote from Hunt for Red October, which is "Wang ping Vasily, one ping only."
Well, and then later on, they evolved that to say, I need an acknowledgement that doesn't sound like they're pulling, clicking their microphone, because NASA can hear that. And it begins to make people suspicious as to why they're doing it. And so he says, on your next check-in with NASA, insert this word and we'll know that you have heard us and agreed to do this, what we've sent you in.
That was another one that I thought, this needs to be a comedy. I mean, they give him a very simple word that was easy for him to insert. But, I kind of imagined that they said, in your response, insert the word cucumber. And how am I going to do that and make it sound natural? All of that stuff is exceedingly unlikely, but he makes you believe it.
Yeah, it's dancing right there on that edge to where you have to be careful not to pull your audience out of a state of belief. Of disbelief, right? To where they say, no, this bus is not going to jump over a 70-foot gap on a bridge, no matter how fast you drive it, even if Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock are behind the steering wheel.
Or because I watched the Blues Brothers movie recently, if you jump off a bridge, you don't drop from 1,400 feet over Chicago skyline.
Big bridges in Chicago, very big bridges.
Very big.
This goes back to something we've talked about before on the podcast, which is the dividing line between fantasy and science fiction. And something I've mentioned before is what H.G. Wells said. When H.G. Wells is telling you one of his science fiction tales, what he's trying to do is convince you that the impossible is possible, but then get the story over with as quickly as possible while that illusion it still holds. And I think that's what Hadfield is doing here. He's grounding everything in stuff that feels real because it's based on his own experience. From that, he is then moving to these more and more unlikely events. But you still go along with it because you think, well, he's an astronaut. This must be true, mustn't it? So you're carried along with it. But also the pace of it goes faster and faster as we go through. That's one of the things that surprised me about the book. I felt the pace increase as we went through. So it really is a thriller by the end of the book, which at first, it didn't feel like a thriller. It felt like a sort of a middle-of-the-road science fiction story. But by the end, it very much felt like a thriller. So what would we say to somebody who is sitting on the fence as to whether to read The Apollo Murders? Who does this book appeal to, do you think?
Boy.
I would label this under alternate history.
Mm-hmm.
Techno-thriller for sure, too.
Yeah. If you like Cold War, if you like, it's a mix between Hunt. I think one of the reviews on Amazon said this. It's a mix between Hunt for Red October and The Martian, or Project Hail Mary. Which I feel makes a lot of sense, given that it is around that same time period. And I kind of was expected to hear Jack Ryan's name in the CIA, but that's a whole other thing. But if you like Cold War era stuff, if you love the Apollo missions, this is a good book to read.
I'd go along with that, absolutely. Yeah, and that's why I leapt at the chance of reading it, actually, because I am an Apollo nerd. And yeah, I just love stuff set during the Cold War era. Science fiction stuff. I mean, I don't sort of bother with spy stories and that sort of thing. But yeah, something like this. It felt like it was written just for me, even though there are some things about it that I still go, really?
Well, as an Apollo nerd, was there anything new that you learned that you hadn't known before?
Really only those very tiny details, like where particular rooms are within buildings. I think all of the stuff about Apollo itself was not new to me. There were a couple of things that made me think, oh, I'll have to go and look that up. One of which is, can you open the hatch on the lunar module from the outside?
Oh.
I didn't think you could, or at least I didn't think there were any handles on the outside, because there is never a circumstance when there should be somebody outside. I mean, yeah, not normally. this book proves that there is, because you might have somebody you want to keep out. But in normal times, there shouldn't be anybody outside. I do remember reading once, I think it was in one of Buzz Aldrin's books, that as he was descending from the lunar module, Neil Armstrong's already out on the moon, Buzz Aldrin is coming down from the lunar module, mm-hmm. and he sort of says to himself, must remember not to close the door. They've got to leave the door open so they can get back in again. So that makes me think there is no way of latching or unlatching the door from the outside. But I may be wrong on that. But all the rest of it absolutely chimes with the details that I'm familiar with. So it felt very real to me.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was, because just having only one door on a lunar module seems like only having one handle just seems kind of like a weird... we'll just like tell everyone like leave the door ajar. That just seems like a weird, like that seems like a weird unnecessary risk. But also, it wouldn't surprise me if that was something that was added after the Apollo 1 disaster. Yeah. So
yeah. But don't forget, there were quite a few things where they really had to pare back on everything in order to save weight. And there were a couple of key parts of the Apollo system where there was only one of them. So, for instance, getting back off the surface of the moon, there's only one engine there that can get you off the moon. If that engine didn't work, you'd be stuck. Mm-hmm. And there was no way of rescuing people from the moon. There was literally no facility for a moon rescue. So everything, they put all of their eggs in the one basket of that one rocket engine in the lunar module to get them back. And similarly, to get back from the moon, you've got one rocket engine available to you. And if that one didn't fire, they're dead.
Yeah.
So they did make savings all over the place. Something else that occurred to me is that the skin of the lunar module is very, very thin, mm-hmm. because it only ever was to be used in the vacuum of space. They didn't make it out of aluminium or this sort of rigid aluminium. It was made more or less out of foil. I mean, it had rigid structures, but the skin of it was really very, very thin. So it occurred to me that the cosmonaut, in reality, might have been able to just poke a hole in it and climb through. But, that would be a different book.
That would be. Well, and it opens up more questions like... The Russian space station that they're sent up to sabotage has a gun on it, and they don't know this at the time. And the gun fires, which is how the American astronaut and I think the Russian astronaut both die. But if it had pierced the skin of the lander, the mission's over.
Yeah.
Because they can't hold enough oxygen in just their life support systems to land, do anything, and take back off.
Yeah. And actually that adds weight to my thing about them delaying the TLI maneuver, because they knew they'd been shot at, but they didn't know whether any damage had been done. They should really have stayed in orbit for one more orbit to sort of suss out the damage, but they didn't, because as Peter says, there was a pressing need to move on with the mission. And I think Chad, the commander's pressing need to do it as well. That's something else I think I want to say. For much of the book, Chad could have been the hero. But I think what Chris Hadfield does very cleverly is he makes him this very driven alpha male who in some circumstances could be a hero, but is so driven that he sort of crosses the line. And I think there's an interesting observation in there about the type of person it takes or took to be an astronaut in those days, the type of people who ended up in that role, a sort of hovering on the edge of being superhero or being batshit crazy, for want of a better phrase.
Exactly.
It goes with the territory, I think. But he builds that into the character. He sort of recognises that. And I suspect that's why he's got the Kaz character. I think Kaz is probably the stand-in for Chris Hadfield, because he's afraid that you'll think that Chad is really Chris.
Oh.
You see what I mean? Because Chad is the commander. The reader is likely to assume that that's the Chris Hadfield character. I'm purely speculating here, but I wouldn't be surprised.
There's the famous adage about, you know, does Indiana Jones really matter?
Mm-hmm.
In Indiana Jones and the
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
At Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? If you take Indiana Jones, does the story change at all? And the general answer is no, because the Nazis still get the Ark, and they open it and it destroys the island. And that, I mean, everything is pretty much the same. Indy just comes and delays things several times. Kaz is our semi-omniscient observer. He doesn't actually contribute a lot to the plot. He's there to watch and make comments and talk to people, which is how you get knowledge without the author just, you know, giving you great big information dumps. Yeah, he's an interface. You know, I think two things. I would really love to have read the original manuscript before it was edited. I think there's been some incredible editing on this piece. And I think there's an incredible adaptation waiting in this book. And in adapting it, it's going to have to be pared down. You can't possibly take all the content.
I think there are several ways of doing it, and I think it could emphasize all the wrong things. My fear with Hollywood adaptations is that they would take all of the most outlandish parts of the story and just give us those and not give us the solid grounding in reality which the book gives. The book takes you from something that is highly plausible to something that really stretches credulity. I think the Hollywood version would just be all the incredible bits. I hate that film already, and they haven't made it yet.
Well, if any Hollywood producers or directors are listening to our podcast, and we know there must be hundreds of them,
definitely.
Both Phil and I are willing to consult with you to help you make more credible, believable, real science adaptations.
Absolutely. And Peter can join us as well.
Oh, definitely. Because we would only represent an older audience, and Peter can represent the younger.
I don't know. I feel like the worst mistake would be to try to modernize it.
Oh, yeah.
I watched the Amazon Prime Jack Ryan series with John Krasinski, who I'm a big fan of, but they modernized his story, and so you lose so many of the Cold War era aspects of the John Ryan character, of the Jack Ryan character. Like, you can't really pull off A Hunt for Red October in this current climate as well. Same with Patriot Games. Although that one you could probably do in a modern setting, but still, you lose so many of this background source material for this character that you would kind of really like. If you tried doing this on a space shuttle, it just wouldn't do anything because it doesn't go anywhere. So I feel like you'd have to try to do this like retro throwback. You have to stick with the Apollo missions. There's no other way around it.
I think you're right, and I think that those missions are so iconic as well that it takes a lot of guts to inject a fictional thread into that sort of well-established history, especially since Hollywood has mythologized the whole Apollo approach to space. But let's see what they do. Colin, do you have a quiz?
I do. Given that my son was the source of a quiz that I had to take, once he expressed interest in coming onto my podcast, I knew that I would have to give him a quiz. And so this is a competitive quiz between Phil and Peter. What I'd like you to do is type your answers privately to me on Facebook. So, 5 questions from a recent episode of Jeopardy. So if there are Jeopardy watchers, you have a definite advantage. The topic is science fiction movie plots.
Okay.
Are you both ready?
Because these are Jeopardy-based, do we have to type our answers in the form of a question?
Oh, yes.
Or are you just converting them? Are you converting them to basic questions to begin with?
Well, I will read the answer, and you should each type me a question.
Okay.
So number 1, Rick retires replicants. Roy ruminates in rain.
My laptop is in a funny position, so I'm having to type one-handed. So forgive the lack of capitals.
No problem. The correct question is, what is Blade Runner? And you are both correct.
Hooray.
I didn't anticipate a tie being possible, but yes. Okay. Question two. Linguistics Last learns lexicon of labyrinthine life forms.
Could you say that again, please?
Linguistics Last learns lexicon of labyrinthine life forms. Oh, yes, Peter has corrected his answer. Arrival is not correct, but what is Arrival in the form of a question is. You are both correct. That is the movie Arrival. You should, if you haven't read the original short story, you should all go and read it. It was wonderful.
My first thought was Project Hail Mary, but that's a little too recent for Jeopardy. Because there's like a solid, 80 pages of that book devoted to just a language?
Yep.
All right. Question three. Beleaguered botanist bolsters base, buddies bounce back, boost on board.
Can we have that again, please?
Can I get alliteration for 800, please, Alex?
Beleaguered botanist bolsters base, buddies bounce back, boost on board. Okay, all of our contestants have chimed in. The correct answer is, what is The Martian?
Oh.
So, Phil, I think with Silent Running, you definitely picked up on the botanist aspect.
I did.
I have to confess, when I first read that question, I thought they were talking about the Batman movie that has Poison Ivy in it.
Oh, the one we do not mention?
Yes. Well, actually, we don't mention hardly any of them.
Except for the first one. The first one's good.
Yes. Peter takes a one-point lead. It's 3-2. Our next one. Aging actors assume anterior aspects. Alan aids admiring aliens against annihilation. Let me reread that.
Please.
Aging actors assume anterior aspects. Alan aids admiring aliens against annihilation.
I need to know what the word anterior means. What does that mean?
Previous.
Previous. Give me the question again.
Aging actors assume anterior aspects. Alan aids admiring aliens against annihilation.
I know the answer to this, but I can't think of the title.
Well, my answer is definitely wrong, so just say it out loud.
It is not the movie Interstellar, Peter. You are correct.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, that is not right.
I just blanked on the title. I think it's that film which has won an award as one of the best Star Trek films ever made, even though it's not a Star Trek film.
Tell me a little more about it.
Into Darkness?
No, but I see what you did there. It's got Alan Rickman. It's got Sigourney Weaver in it. They are actors from a science fiction TV show who get visited by aliens who think they're real.
With Tim Allen in it.
Yes.
Oh, it's going to drive me nuts now.
It's Galaxy Quest.
That's it.
Yes.
Galaxy Quest.
Is that the right answer?
That is the right answer. We're going to award Phil that point.
Phew.
That's fair.
Okay. Back into a 3-3 tie. The fifth and final question for either a final tie or for the one who takes home all the popcorn. Cruise and Crafty Computer collaborate on crimes not yet committed.
Oh.
Can we have that one again, please?
Cruise and Crafty Computer collaborate on crimes not yet committed.
Oh.
I think I know which one this is. I just can't remember the name. And I can't Google this, can I?
Nope.
Because I think I know the story, but I just can't think of the title right now.
That's exactly how I was with Galaxy Quest.
Tell me everything you can remember about it, and it will trigger something.
There are the people who can see in the future and see crimes. It was made into a movie or two. It's not Total Recall, is it? It's not.
No.
No.
But there is a connection.
Yes. It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger, is it? No. Oh, what is it?
Read him the question again, Colin.
Cruise and Crafty Computer collaborate on crimes not yet committed.
Tom Cruise?
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes.
Yeah, I still can't think of the title that. And the second he says it, it's going to be like blatantly obvious to me, isn't it?
Yes. It's based off a Philip K. Dick novella called?
Yes.
Minority Report.
There it is. Yeah, I was stuck on Total. I was thinking Total Recall and just got stuck on Total Recall. I couldn't think of anything else but Total Recall.
The first couple of times you read the question, when you said cruise, I I pictured CREWS, like cruise of a spaceship.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. And so my thought was, I don't know, for the first thing I thought of was 2001.
But yes, me too.
They don't collaborate much in that.
No.
not after a little while. I have to say that it goes 4-3 to Phil. So congratulations, Phil.
Woo-hoo. Wow, thank you. What's the prize?
Well, there's certainly bragging rights that go on.
Thank you for your wonderful Jeopardy-inspired quiz.
Thank you.
And I think you've got a suitable revenge on Peter there.
The next time he guests, we'll consider all debts paid.
Now, we're going to run out of time very soon, so I think we should do our quick run-through of the usual things we do, which is talking about past, present, and future science fiction. So have either of you got any recommendations of science fiction from the past?
Reread Dune. If you haven't read it for the first time. You'll find it challenging in a lot of ways, and it will lead you to go to see this incredible movie that is now in theaters.
Is it actually good?
I believe so, yeah.
I need to hear you say this out loud. Is it a good adaptation?
Boy.
Oh, he's hedging his bets.
Well, I'm a little reactive. I've learned to calm down and not to just jump on things. Yes, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. It is a good adaptation. There are changes made to it. I don't think I like or agree with all of them, but it doesn't hurt the movie.
But your recommendation is go and read the book.
Well, I'm not sure that the movie completely stands on its own alone. There is so much information that they're putting at you all the time, and a lot of it very quickly, that unless you're familiar with it, I'm afraid you'd lose track of it all.
Yeah. From what I remember from Dune, I feel like they'd have to cut down a lot on the like world building of it.
Yep.
It's kind of like the Earth stuff from Ender's Game, I feel like, is a good comparison. The stuff that happens when Peter and Valentine.
Yes.
Okay.
I was saying before we started recording that I've never got on with Dune. I started reading it probably in about 1980. I think I got about a third of the way through and just gave up. And in fact, I never went back to anything by Frank Herbert. I sort of felt badly burned by the experience. The book just didn't do anything for me. So, but maybe I need to revisit. But I'll probably watch the film because that'll be an easier way in, I think.
Oh, yeah. You can get the whole movie in. And if the second movie is as long as the first, you'll be done in 5 hours.
Wonderful. I'm going to cheat. I said, have you got any recommendations of past science fiction? Well, I'm going to do some science fact. Because we were looking at the Apollo murders, there's a book that I would recommend called Apollo to the Moon, A History in 50 Objects, which I think came out about 3 or 4 years ago. It's lavishly illustrated. And basically what it is, they take a load of space-related objects from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and tell you the story of each one. So there's some really fantastic things in here. For example, just trying to find it in the book, I think it's Surveyor 3's camera. Surveyor 3 was an unmanned probe that the Americans sent to the moon before Apollo. And when Apollo 12 landed on the moon, they landed it right next to the Surveyor probe, so close that they could send the astronauts to go and collect the camera and bring it back to Earth. So it's just one of these many objects featured in the book. So that's my recommendation. Apollo to the Moon by the unlikely named Teasel Muir Harmony. What about present science fiction? What are you guys reading or watching presently?
I've been rereading the Brandon Sanderson's Skyward series, because there are a series of new ebook novellas coming out in anticipation of the release of the third book in November. It's young adult science fiction, really, really enjoyable, with great topics that are very topical. For example, in the second book, there's this complete misunderstanding about communication, because one alien uses a facial expression which means one thing to them, but a completely different thing to us. And it's a lesson for the main character to understand that, you know, people act and think and say things in ways that we aren't always used to, and this only makes them different, not bad.
you've recommended him before. Clearly, you're still on a Sanderson kick. Peter, what have you been reading or watching lately?
Also by Brandon Sanderson is the Reckoners series. I'm not sure if that's more fantasy or sci-fi. I think it's sci-fi parts. I think it's like a mix of sci-fi and fantasy, but it's a place where there's this weird star in the sky that gives random people superpowers, and every time they use their superpowers, it corrupts them morally. It's basically, what if there were supervillains with no superheroes, and people who try to fight back against them? Good book.
Great, thank you. Clearly there's a Cusky family interest in Sanderson books.
Well, I tend to buy quite a few, and so they're always available for people to borrow and read.
And what about the future? Have you heard of any new future projects coming up that are of interest to you?
I'm going to pull a trick like you did. So just a few days ago, which would be in October of 2021, the Ursula K. Le Guin Prize for Fiction was announced. It's $25,000 to be awarded yearly by a rotating list of judges. And the criteria is to write fiction in a way similar to Ursula K. Le Guin did, with this particular quote being a guide. "Hard times are coming when we'll be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now, can see through our fear-stricken society and its obsessive technologies to other ways of being, and even imagine real grounds for hope. We'll need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, realists of a larger reality." And wow. I'm really excited to see the writing that inspires.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say you were inspired to start writing.
Oh, yeah. A few years back, I was inspired to write an Apollo story. But the more research I've done and the more I've tried to write, it reminds me I'm not a writer.
Basically, on one of the Apollo missions, there was a bunch of stamps, if I remember correctly, yeah, that were brought on the mission, and then some might have been left behind.
Yeah.
And so Dad wanted to write a book about people going and collecting those stamps and bringing them back.
Oh, that's fantastic. Stamp collectors in space.
Yeah, the Apollo astronauts were not overly well paid. And so to provide for college saving plans or insurance or other things, they would often carry things to the moon and back, which would then be resold for substantial amounts of money. There's a bunch of cash. There's stamps, extra golf balls, quite a few
golf
things,
club.
To be honest. Golf club.
I think Apollo 15 was the one where the astronauts got in trouble for that. I think it was Dave Scott was the sort of the ringleader who sort of set up this scheme of taking stamps to the moon. And the other crew members were kind of dragged into it, but blamed him for it. And funnily enough, I've just been reading a new book. So this counts as my present reading item. Before I started reading The Apollo Murders, I was reading Al Warden's book, The Light of Earth. Al Warden was the command module pilot on Apollo 15. And he wrote a book previously, which I thought was really good. Apollo 15 was one of the lesser missions. It wasn't that important in the whole of Apollo. And yet his book made the mission very vivid and made it seem very important. And it's one of the best written books by an astronaut. And he wrote a follow-up to it. And then he died. I think he died last year or earlier this year. And the book's just come out recently. So it's a posthumous second book from... Well, actually, it's not his second book, but it's his second autobiographical volume. And for the future, I'm going to be rather vague and non-specific, but I'm going to be involved in a couple of Ray Bradbury-related events in the next couple of months, which will be online things that I'm going to be involved with. So I'm not going to say any more at this point, basically because I don't have any detail at this point, but I will give detail when I have it. But watch this space. And of course, it's very nearly Halloween, which is Bradbury season, because he wrote several books with a kind of October or Halloween theme. So everyone should read those at this time of year, in my view.
Yes.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me.
You're very welcome. I commiserate with you on your quiz not winningness, but I thank you for setting a quiz for us earlier in our run.
It was kind of, I'll say the term sci-fi I feel like is getting diluted recently with like a bunch of stuff that I don't think should be considered sci-fi. Like there's a bunch like when I tried Googling like sci-fi quizzes, half the ones that popped up were like, oh, name this character from Hunger Games.
Oh yeah.
And I don't feel like that's a good idea.
I think we're done. So thanks, guys. I feared that I would be outnumbered today with two Cuskies against me, but it's been very enjoyable. Thank you very much. I enjoyed reading the Apollo murders along with you, and we'll put some links on the blog for this show. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Cuskie, and our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com, and look for the show notes on our website 101sf.blogspot.com, and also find us as Science Fiction 101 on Facebook. And finally, please subscribe wherever you find us. We are on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Player FM, Pocket Casts, Podbean, the podcast app. Wherever you get your podcasts, that's where we are. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.